Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're diving into a pretty interesting case today, something with a lot of practical implications, especially for law students out there. The case is Bismillah v. St. John Fisher College.
Yes, it's a really good illustration of how these things that you might think are separate, like campus disciplinary stuff and settlement agreements and defamation law, how those things can all come together in a case.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty complicated. So let's start with the basics of this case. It involves a guy named Franck Bissouma, who was a freshman at St. John Fisher College.
Right.
And, you know, he was accused of sexual misconduct, went through the college's disciplinary process, was found responsible, and was expelled. Obviously a huge consequence.
Yeah, no question. And what makes this case even more, I guess, layered, is that he was also facing criminal charges for the same incident. We're talking first and third degree rape charges.
Well, okay, so that's serious.
Very serious. But here's where it gets interesting. He was actually acquitted in the criminal trial. So you have these two different outcomes, found responsible by the college, but acquitted in court.
So like two different systems, two different results.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sets the stage for the legal issues that come later.
Definitely. Okay, so after the acquittal, Bissimwar and the college, they reach a settlement agreement.
Okay, so what were the key parts of that agreement?
Well, college actually made a pretty big concession in the settlement. They acknowledged that new evidence had come to light, actually testimony that wasn't part of that initial campus hearing. And they said that this new evidence could have, you know, potentially changed the outcome of their finding.
Interesting.
So as part of the settlement, they agreed to basically erase, expunge all these disciplinary notations from his record, from his transcript, anything they might share with anyone else.
So a clean slate, basically.
Well, kind of. There's a really important caveat here. The actual expulsion from the college, that remained.
Oh, I see. So his records were cleared up, but the consequence, the expulsion itself, was still in place.
Exactly.
Gotcha. And so this is where the whole issue of breaching the settlement agreement comes in, right?
Yes.
Because Bissimwa, he applies to transfer to SUNY Buffalo, and I guess this is where things get messy.
Yeah, he claims that St. John Fisher College, despite this agreement to basically scrub his record clean, disclosed his disciplinary history to SUNY Buffalo as part of the transfer process.
And that's where the first legal claim arises, right? Breach of contract.
Precisely. He argued that, look, the settlement said they wouldn't share this info, and by telling SUNY Buffalo anything, that was a breach, regardless of the specifics of what they actually shared. And then on top of that, he also files a claim for defamation by implication.
Defamation by implication. Okay, now that's where things get a little more complex, right? Because he's saying the college, even though they were maybe technically accurate in what they shared, still defamed him.
Right. His argument was essentially that by simply disclosing the reason for his expulsion, which was sexual misconduct, they were implying that he was guilty even though he had been acquitted in court.
So he's saying they created this negative impression, this implied guilt, even if they didn't outright say it.
Exactly.
So essentially he's challenging them on two fronts. One, did they break their promise? And two, even if what they said was technically true, did they still defame him?
Yeah, pretty much.
So let's break this down. First, let's look at that breach of contract claim. The main question there seems to be whether the college, by sharing anything at all with SUNY Buffalo, violated that agreement.
Right. And the court really looked closely at the language of the settlement agreement, and they basically said, yep, the agreement did require the college to keep certain disciplinary actions confidential. So by communicating anything about the disciplinary history to SUNY Buffalo, the college was in breach of contract.
So the court sided with Bissimwa on that?
On that part, yes. Specifically against the college itself, against St. John Fisher College.
Right. Okay. But Bissimwa didn't just sue the college. He also named the assistant dean of students in the lawsuit.
Teriel Travellini, yes.
Right. And he was trying to hold her personally responsible.
Right. He wanted her to be personally liable.
So this brings up a whole other area of contract law, doesn't it? Like,
yeah.
When can an individual be held responsible for their employer's actions, for the actions of the institution?
Exactly. This goes to the heart of agency law. And in this case, right, you have the assistant dean. She's acting as an agent of the college, which is what we call the disclosed principal. So she's basically doing her job, acting on behalf of the college.
And what's the general rule, legally speaking, about when someone like that, acting as an agent, can be held personally liable for a breach of contract?
So under New York law, and really in a lot of places, an agent acting on behalf of a disclosed principal, like in this situation, they're not personally liable for a breach of contract that the principal enters into. It's understood that the agreement is between the principal and the other party, not between the agent, who's really just working on behalf of their organization, and the other party.
Okay, but I'm guessing there are exceptions to this rule.
Of course, there's always an exception, right? An agent can be held personally liable if there's clear evidence that the agent intended to be personally bound by the contract. So it's not enough that they're just doing their job. There has to be this clear indication that they were also committing themselves as an individual to the terms of the agreement.
So, like putting themselves on the line personally.
Exactly.
And in this case, did the court find any evidence that the assistant dean intended to be personally bound by this settlement?
Nope. Not at all. The court specifically pointed out that Bisimwa didn't even allege that Travellini intended to be personally bound. And without that, without that clear claim and evidence that she meant to take on that personal responsibility, the court said, nope, she can't be held personally liable for the breach.
That's a really important distinction, right? You can be acting on behalf of an organization, but that doesn't automatically mean you're personally agreeing to everything in a contract. It has to be clear that that was your intent.
Absolutely. And the court even highlighted this in their decision, saying, and I quote, "Plaintiff did not allege that Travellini intended to be personally bound." So that's something for law students to really keep in mind.
Okay, so that's the breach of contract claim.
Right.
So that moves forward against the college, but the claim against the assistant dean is dismissed.
Right.
Let's talk about that second claim, this defamation by implication claim.
Yeah.
This seems like a really tricky area, right? Because we're not talking about the college straight up lying. They're basically stating the reason for the expulsion, which was based on their findings.
It definitely gets into some murky legal territory. The key question is whether the college disclosing this truth, that Bisimwa was expelled for sexual misconduct, whether that can be seen as defamatory just because of the negative implications it might create, especially given that he was found not guilty in the criminal case.
And how does a court even decide if a truthful statement can be considered defamatory just because of what people might infer from it? That seems really subjective.
Well, there's a two-part test the courts use for defamation by implication, specifically when the statement itself is factually true. The first part of the test is whether the communication could reasonably be understood to mean something defamatory. So, like, would a reasonable person hearing that Basimwa was expelled for sexual misconduct jump to a negative conclusion about him, maybe even connect it to criminal behavior?
So it's not just about what's technically true, it's about how it's likely to be perceived, how a reasonable person would interpret it.
Exactly. And the second part of the test, this is usually the tougher part to prove, is showing that the speaker, in this case the college, actually intended or endorsed that defamatory interpretation.
Oh, so it's not enough that someone could draw a negative conclusion. Bisimwa had to show that the college was either trying to suggest something bad about him,
Yeah.
or they just didn't care if people did.
You're right. It's about what the speaker was trying to communicate, not just about how the listener might interpret things.
So, what did the court ultimately decide about this defamation claim?
They dismissed it. They acknowledged, of course, that the disclosure mentioned sexual misconduct as the reason for the expulsion. But they also pointed out that it didn't mention the criminal charges and it didn't mention his acquittal. Importantly, the court also said that the college, not including those details of the settlement agreement, like that part where they acknowledged there was new evidence, that didn't mean they were being dishonest or creating a false narrative. The college, according to the court, never actually said they were wrong about Bisimwa being responsible for the misconduct, and they never reversed his expulsion.
So, just stating the true reason for the expulsion, even if it's something that has these really negative connotations, it's not automatically defamation by implication.
Right, especially when you consider that he was found responsible for something, even if it wasn't the same thing in criminal court. And the court made this very clear in their reasoning. They basically said, and this is a quote, "The disclosure of being found responsible in a student disciplinary proceeding for sexual misconduct and assault, as defined in a student code of conduct, does not imply that there was a criminal proceeding, let alone that the result of any such criminal proceeding was a conviction for rape, as defined by the penal law."
Wow. So they're basically saying there's a difference between a finding by a college and a conviction in a court of law.
Exactly. And their point is that the college was just talking about their own decision, their own disciplinary process, not suggesting anything about the criminal case.
So it seems like proving defamation by implication, especially when the statement itself is true, that's a pretty high bar.
It is. You really have to be able to show that the person or the institution making the statement, they were intentionally trying to communicate that defamatory meaning. It's not enough just to say, well, someone could take it the wrong way.
Okay, so stepping back a bit, what are the big takeaways from this case? What should our listeners, especially the law students out there, really remember about this?
So I'd say a couple of really important things. First, this case really highlights the concept of agency in law, right? We talked about that. Usually when someone's acting as an agent for their employer, they're not personally liable for breaches of contract unless they clearly intended to be.
Right. They have to personally assume that obligation.
Exactly. And second, it provides a really good example of how the courts analyze defamation by implication, particularly in cases where the underlying facts are actually true. It's hard to prove defamation if someone's just stating the truth, even if it leads to negative inferences.
And when it comes to settlement agreements, what's the big lesson there?
Clarity, clarity, clarity. The court really emphasized the importance of using very precise language, especially in those non-disclosure clauses, so everyone knows exactly what information can and cannot be shared. You know, the court didn't really talk about the specific wording of this agreement, but generally speaking, in contract law, if there's any ambiguity in a contract, it's often interpreted against the person or the institution that wrote it. So institutions, like colleges in this case, they really have to be careful, super specific in these agreements to avoid these kinds of legal fights later on. For you, the listener, if you're going into contract law, think about this. When you're writing these clauses, could you specify exactly what can and can't be shared, even in different situations like a transfer application? You know, maybe you even explain why the information has to be kept confidential so there's no question about the overall intention of the agreement.
That's a really good point, because sometimes those non-disclosure clauses can be pretty vague.
Exactly. And this case really highlights the potential problems that can arise from that lack of clarity.
So there are some really practical takeaways here, not just for lawyers, but for anyone involved in these kinds of agreements.
Absolutely. And beyond those specific legal lessons, there are also some broader implications here. The court pointed out that punitive damages, that's money awarded to punish the defendant, those weren't available in this case because it was essentially a private contract dispute and it didn't involve a violation of some major public policy.
Interesting. So certain types of legal wrongs are seen as more serious and warranting that extra punishment, those punitive damages.
Right. And, you know, this case also really shows just how difficult it is for colleges to balance all these different factors when they're dealing with student discipline. They have to be transparent, but they also have confidentiality obligations and they have to uphold their contracts. It's a tough situation.
Yeah, it's like they're in a bind, right? They're required to provide information during a transfer process, but disclosing even true information can really damage someone's reputation, especially in today's world where information spreads so quickly.
Exactly. It's this tension between transparency and privacy, and that's something lawyers and policymakers will continue to grapple with.
So to recap, some key takeaways for our listeners. When it comes to contracts, remember that personal liability for agents, that's not the norm. There has to be clear intent for that to happen. With defamation, proving that the speaker intended to imply something negative, that's a really high bar, especially when the underlying statement is true. And for anyone dealing with settlement agreements, especially those with non-disclosure clauses, be as clear and specific as possible to avoid problems down the road.
Exactly. Be very intentional about what you're agreeing to and what you're expecting others to do.
I think that's great advice for all of us. So one final thought, especially for the aspiring lawyers in our audience. Think about the position colleges are in when they're trying to resolve these disciplinary cases through settlements. Even when they follow the letter of the agreement and only disclose things that are technically true, there's still this possibility that they could really hurt someone's reputation. So how could these agreements be written differently in the future to try to prevent that? To protect both the institution and the individual involved? How do we balance student privacy with the need for transparency in a world where information is so easily shared and can be really hard to erase completely? These are tough questions, but this case, Bessemwa v. St. John Fisher College, gives us a lot to think about as we try to figure out these issues.
It really does. This case highlights some crucial legal and ethical issues that come up in this area where campus discipline, settlement agreements, and defamation law intersect.
Well, thanks for diving deep with us today. This was a really thought-provoking discussion.
My pleasure.
And for everyone listening, until next time, keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll see you on our next deep dive.